You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that have made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Vice President of Creative Strategy, Innovation, and Business Development at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, discovering connections, and building a better future. This is Getting the Yes And.
We welcome Scott Barry Coffin back to the podcast to talk about his new book. It's called Rise Above, Overcome a Victim Mindset, Empower Yourself, and Realize Your Full Potential. Enjoy the pod.
Unsaid. Days can't be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The corner of the highway that leads to the job at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moments till the ticking stops.
But over time, Scott Barry Coffin, welcome to the podcast again.
Oh my gosh, what an honor. What an honor, Kelly. I'm such a big fan of you.
I'm a big fan as well. I know. And
but you first and foremost.
Oh, well, that's nice to hear. That's very nice to hear. I love that you open your book with a Joan Rivers quote, who is a Second City alum. And she famously said, listen, I wish I could tell you it gets better, but it doesn't get better. You get better.
You know, I think you need a little bit of hilarity about life or else you'll go crazy.
1,000%.
I think Joan Rivers got it. Joan Rivers got it.
Yeah. And this is something I think is absolutely true based on my experience. Like, it doesn't get better. It does. It, like, we're sitting here today in the year of our Lord 2025, January 30th. Could there be more craziness, insanity all over the world? And, you know, all of that is going on. And yet, as you get older, as I think both of us have gotten older, you find different coping mechanisms. You find ways to channel. You do this mental time travel. And what I always think back is my parents talking to me about what it was like living in 1968, 69, 70, 71, 72.
Mm.
Pretty bad.
Yeah. No, I think you're right.
So you then write in the book, quote, my entire career has been an attempt to discover our greatest potential and show people what's truly possible, to help people break out of their imprisoning labels and show that diagnoses aren't destiny. But somehow in the past few years, this idea has become controversial, end quote. Have you faced backlash on that idea?
I face backlash all the time on this idea. I had this woman stand up in a talk I gave the other day virtually, but she still stood up. It was like unnecessary, which is funny. It's funny in and of itself. She's like, I find books called Rise Above problematic, you know, because they don't acknowledge black people. And I'm like, wait a minute, what? I wait, it's like, that's one of those like, wait a minute, what moments? It's like, I totally think black people are just as capable and have hope for their future as anyone else. I want to stand up for and help anyone, regardless of their demographic, overcome their circumstances and live an empowered life. So it's just like, it just boggles my mind. But there is a certain world. But my point is, there is a particular worldview that is at odds with the message of my book. And they're a huge minority, but they exist. And I don't know quite what to do with them.
Well, they're, from what you've read this research, right? The loudest voices on the right and the left, let's just say that, are the fringe voices, because they get the attention for that. So because it's not like you're denying systemic racism within the book. It's not, that's not, and also that's not your area of study.
No,
your area
correct.
Of study is human beings, their potential. And this is personal for you. And I know we talked about that your very first time on the podcast, but I'd love you people to know a bit of your backstory in terms of the struggles that you've had in your life to get where I don't think very young Scott Barry Coffin thinks he's doing this podcast right now.
You know, it's interesting to think about that, because I did have this, oddly enough, I've always had this really strong, like, self-belief and grandiosity. So actually, okay. I don't know if I agree with that statement you just said.
That's fair.
I would say no one else would have imagined this. I would absolutely say. But even in my own head, you know, at age four, I had fantasies of like giving keynote talks. And I think that, you know, this really is in line with the point of my book, which is, you know, no one's coming to save you, you know, and I say that in the introduction, and it's just a harsh reality. I have a whole section in my intro, which I know you read, on the givens of existence. And that's one of the givens, you know, is no one's coming to save you. Like, I realized, like, a light bulb moment went off in my head in ninth grade when a special ed teacher took me aside and was like, you know, what are you still doing in special ed? Because I was in special ed for an auditory learning disability that everyone thought it meant that I was, I don't like the R word.
Yeah.
But actually, I'll use a different label they put on me, slow learner.
Oh, okay.
So look, I was in this moment and I had this like moment, this like light bulb went off, like, wow, no one else is going to come to see me. Not even, you know, my mom, who very, very well-meaning parents, my mom wrote letters to the school system saying, I think my Scotty is a lot more intelligent and smart than you give him credit for. But still my life hadn't changed. I was still in special ed. So I had this moment where I was like, wait, I'm the one who's going to have to make a decision here. Mm-hmm. And I said, you know what? I'd like to have a meeting with the whole school administration, and I'd like to break out of special ed. Can I do that? Is the student himself allowed to do that? And they're like, well, that's never happened before. No student in special ed has ever himself or herself, or nowadays they selves, say, right, like, I'm out.
Yeah.
And I was like, I'm out. And so this is a big point of the book, which is that I've learned in my life over and over again that there's a lot of power in making your own choices about your destiny, because no one in this world can be as good advocate as yourself can be for yourself.
So we've talked about this idea around competitive victimhood, which is a big part of the.
Why don't you just jump right into the deep end, Kelly?
Okay. Don't bury the lead, right? Start in the middle. These are all the things. But the thing is, I think what people need to understand is, and I want you to sort of define the sort of victim mindset, but the greater point being, like, this is not the province of one group. This is right now we live in a world where almost so many people with billions of dollars and massive platforms paint themselves as the victim. People who are, of course, downtrodden and sort of traditional, what we'd see as people we might consider victims, might call that, but it's being taken up by like so many people.
Yeah, I write about the complexities of competitive victimhood, and it's a really rich psychological literature. I'm sorry, Kelly, I'm not going to be able to give you just a simple response, because this is a rabbit hole I went down for a year of a really rich literature. Interestingly, I would say about 65 to 75% of the literature has been conducted by Israeli researchers. Wow. So make of that what you will. Ari Nadler, as well as you know, his colleagues, have done so much research on this, looking through the lens of the Palestinian-Israeli debate. And to their credit, they've looked at it very objectively. So they're not like I don't get a sense they have an agenda. Mm-hmm. You know, when they do their research, they want to really they want to figure out, is reconciliation possible? And so really going down that rabbit hole, I realized the complexities of competitive victimhood. And something that keeps cropping up over and over again is the idea that, you know, you really do get certain benefits from being viewed, perception wise by others as the victim. And so therefore there is this big fight to claim that spot. And that's not saying that, you know, that real victimhood isn't happening. In fact, I would say something which people don't really think this way, but yes, and thinkers do think this way, mm-hmm. which is that I think you could have multiple victims.
Sure.
And we are not like primed to think that way in our society, where we're not primed to hold space for the complexities of there being multiple victims, which I believe we need to really increase that way of thinking in our society. Now, that's not the kind of yes and you talk about, you know, which, but still it's a more integrative, nuanced way of thinking about the world where you're allowed to have compassion for multiple people. and so this field of competitive victimhood, it's a shame because we do have this moral bias where we, if you claim that spot of the victim, it does come with it. You can't do any harm. It does come with it a lot of benefits. You can get away with a lot. And if you get the other, you know, the other side of it, if you're the perpetrator and that's how you're perceived, then you can't do any right. And so we have such a, this kind of black and white way of thinking about things that of course there's this clamoring for that victimhood spot. And I think it's unfortunate because I'm a real peace guy at heart. Mm-hmm. And I'm a real reconciliation guy. I mean, this chapter of my book, what you're referring to is the last chapter of my book. So yeah. You went right to the deep end. But, you know, I talk about, you know, where my heart really is in this is I have a whole, you know, bunch of what can we do about this? How can we get out of this quagmire? I call it the victimhood trap is what I call it. Because I really think we need to get out of it if we're going to move forward as a society.
You know, it might be it is yes and to a certain degree, but it also be what Wendy Smith talks about with both and thinking. And you talk
that's
about
true
this
too.
Both
that's
this
true
bothness
too.
Idea.
Yeah. And Susan David yes. gets credit for that. Yeah,
yeah. Because I think it's very difficult for our people to not.
You're talking about Jews.
No, because I'm not Jewish. Oh, okay. But I mean, the larger human beings.
I'm just joking. Am I allowed to joke on this podcast?
If you aren't, then we have a problem with the podcast. Okay. Oh, and I was going to mention this. Speaking of Jews, let's go there. It's not necessarily surprising to me that they're the ones doing studies here. If you look at like Viktor Frankl's work,
yeah.
This is one of the original people coming in and going, how can I change my frame? And this is a Holocaust survivor. This is someone who is in the camps. You cannot tell me that there was a
right.
person who could own victimhood. Mandela being another, right? Of course, who did followed a similar track, and that's why we still talk about them today.
That's absolutely right. So who were you referring to with our people, by the way?
that human beings in general want something to be right or wrong, black or white. They want things to add up in a certain way.
That's
right. And the zero sum thinking is doing us no favors because it's never true.
Yes, and I'm going to do a lot of yes and with you today. You're like the master of it. I almost said you're the inventor of it.
I'm not the inventor.
I know you're not, but you are the biggest, in my opinion, popularizer of the idea in our society today. And I always cite you whenever I say that. Even in my book, did you follow the reference in my book?
Of course, I look for the citation. I'm not an idiot.
Yeah, of course. I want to give you credit. It really, like your ideas about yes and have really, I mean, it's influenced the main thesis of my book, right? Is that an empowerment mindset is a yes and thinking mindset, whereas a victim mindset is in a lot of ways the opposite of a yes and mindset.
Yeah.
You're not able to hold the space for yes, I've suffered and I have hope, right? Which isn't, that's what an empowerment mindset is. You know, it's kind of like the opposite of a yes and thingy. So I really do want to thank you a lot for, you've really impacted my thinking about this and about what it really means to have self-empowerment. To me, it's being able to hold the bothness of your emotions, of your own, sense of agency and responsibility in the world while acknowledging systemic issues. I can go on and on and on, you know, of yes and things that we're just not doing in our society today. And I think it's not only tearing our society apart, it's, you know, and causing us to view people as the enemy of ourselves when in a lot of ways we're the enemy of ourselves. but it's, causing groups to hate each other. You know, I just saw a statistic. I don't know if this is relevant at all, but just like our misconstrued perceptions about groups, like, you know, just edit that out. You have editing capabilities, right? I'm not even going to go there. But I'll tell you off the record something interesting.
Okay. Let me just mark.
I don't want to go on to a whole other.
That's fine. You know, we both had Kurt Gray on our podcast.
Yes, I love him.
I love him too.
He blurred my book. He blurred my book.
Oh, that's terrific. Well, you know, this idea of understanding moral outrage, that all of us are working from a harm-based perspective, kind of gives us a roadmap for why we're in this, right? That this goes back eons to the, you know, to prehistoric times where so when I think about that, I'm like, oh, well, I guess I can see why. And if I can see why, there should be an opportunity to fix it or change it. Or in your case, where you talk about the idea of being flexible as a key to sort of getting out of that victim mindset.
Oh, absolutely. You know, there's a rich literature in psychology called psychological flexibility. And it's just the opposite way of what I'm seeing in our society. You know, you can move in the direction of your values even if you don't feel like it. You know, it's like people didn't get that memo. You know, even if you're angry, even if you're preoccupied with your short-term concerns, you can still move in the direction of your values. This is why I created a form of coaching called self-actualization coaching, which I'm really excited about. That's a big part of my life these days as well. And we just started a training program for coaches, a 6-month program where we train them, certify them in being self-actualization coaches, already existing coaches. And a big part of that is when you have a client, you know, working with them and acknowledging all the ways in which they are getting in the way of their self-actualization. And we get in the way of our self-actualization all the time. I really do believe, and I say this in the book, I stand by it, the victim mindset is probably the number one mindset that gets in the way, the number one inner mindset that can get in the way of self-actualization. Obviously, if you live in a society where you don't know when you're getting your next food, you know, that's a pretty big external barrier to self-actualization, but I'm saying inner barrier. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. So this leads me to want to talk about trauma, which is big business right now, right? You can't go anywhere without seeing the T word.
I just went on a whole Twitter rant about that this morning or yesterday night, blending into this morning. So that's funny you mentioned that.
All right. What were you talking about on Twitter?
Well, so Gabor Mate has this idea that ADHD is the result of childhood trauma and your mother not holding you enough when you were a kid. And and to me, he's peddling a victim mindset. Mm-hmm. And I want to challenge it. It's because it's such a popular narrative and no one's out there really challenging it in a compassionate way. So, yeah, it seemed to have resonated with a lot of people. I mean, the tweet has done really well. And, you know, no disrespect to Gabor, Dr. Mate, who was in the concentration camps, that, you know, who am I to challenge Dr. Mate? But I think there is this big narrative going around about like how everything's trauma and everything has to be blamed on, you know, your parents. And if you're going to blame your parents for anything, I think you should blame them for giving you their genes.
But that genes are part of the equation,
right?
I mean, there's many parts to these.
Well, situations. You know, blame them for giving you their genes and forcing you to grow up in an environment for 18 years where you have a clash between two people with basically the same kind of mishugana. That's a recipe for. Those are the two things. Nature, nurture combined is a recipe for disaster. So, you know what I mean? Like, you know, you have a mother who's incredibly narcissistic and then their child is incredibly narcissistic. And they're both like forced to live with each other for 18 years. You know, it takes a lot of healing to find a partner who's sensitive to your narcissism and isn't like that. And then you go to therapy and you realize, oh, wow, I do have some narcissistic traits. Wow, but I can change. I mean, I do have a message of change at the end of the day, but I'm telling you how the reality of the world, you know, I'm not just like, you know, saying things that people just want to hear. I'm saying some of that locus of control does come from within you.
Mm-hmm. So it's interesting. You talk about parents, which is you obviously love your parents and
I do.
You write about them. And my parents who are gone, I love them dearly. So we both have great parents. However, they are not perfect. Mine weren't, yours weren't, in terms of, you know, and why would we ever expect them to be? And yeah. I'll Nick came home. He's living in Atlanta, our son. He's a Shakespeare actor, which is what he wanted to do, and making zero money and working at a taco place on the side. And at a certain point during dinner, I said, well, I'm sorry your mom and I gave you the illusion you could actually make a living working in the theater. And he goes, don't think I haven't thought about that. I was like, oh, now, it was a joke, but as we know, jokes carry a lot of truth. That's there. That's you know, how we talk about the
opposite. That's funny. That's funny.
Yeah, it is funny. But it's also, there's a truth to it. So I think this is what, because we know each other pretty well, and I think the overwhelming thing in this book is you keep trying to tell people, like, look, I'm not saying your trauma isn't necessarily real, and I'm not saying bad things didn't happen to you. But if you stay in that point of view, if that is your dominant view towards your life, where do you go?
Yeah, it's very true. Where do you go? And even people who have had the worst traumas known to what could be the worst traumas, call me crazy, but I still believe they have hope. That's my worldview, you know, and it's like, I think that it's backed by science too.
Backed by science.
That should be my tagline for everything.
And you need to say it in the base of operating.
Yeah, backed by science.
The research does show that people, like even 9/11, like just how resilient people are. I'm seeing it in these fires in LA. People had their entire houses burned down, and how resilient they are. Now, I'm also not saying that like you need to beat yourself up if you're not resilient. You know, like I think that everything, grief, trauma, it all has a scale, a time scale, and it's okay to be upset and it's okay to be angry. You're also able to have hope for the future and be proactive and constructive in your ruminations.
I want to jump to chapter 5. As I was reading this chapter, I was at home, and I, as I'm wont to do, Anne is sitting in a chair across from me reading whatever she's reading. And then I'm like, oh, you got to hear this. And I'll read some of that. And I remember she said to me, she goes, if Scotty lived in Harry Potter world, he'd be studying the dark arts.
Why is that?
Because you're fascinated with it. You can just tell. It's like you're interested in that dark. So let's.
Oh, that's a good point. That's a really. I'm going to quote you on that someday.
Well, quote Anne. It was her line.
Can I just say something, Kelly, real quick? Because you said you threw out a really profound statement about me, but I think it's not complete. I'm also obsessed with the light side. I would say I'm equally obsessed by both. If that makes sense, yeah.
Well, that makes sense in the parlance of the book perfectly, because it's a yes and, it's a both and. We've talked about this. You can't have suffering without joy. You can't have joy without suffering. They both exist. You're the one who taught me post-traumatic growth.
That's right.
As a concept in the most traumatic period of my life. So that is, and it hasn't gotten easier. It hasn't gotten easier.
No.
We've all just sort of found our ways through. So, pathological altruism is a term that Barbara Oakley uses. You call it excessive or intrusive helping. So can you define this thing?
Sure. I love Barbara Oakley's research on pathological altruism, and I tried to figure out whether or not I could create a scientific study to measure it. And I did create the pathological altruism scale. And I contrasted that with another scale I created called the healthy selfishness scale. And I think both measure a paradoxical form of selfishness. So I think it's possible to be selfish and to, in a healthy way, you know, taking care of yourself, prioritizing your own well-being over the well-being of others at times. So a lot of that is really good for your well-being. And I think also it's possible to overdo it on the altruism and be intrusive. I coined that phrase, intrusive helping. And I think people immediately get it, you know, and you think neurotic Jewish mother, but as the prototype of that. But it's, you know, just giving, you know, where the person didn't even ask for it. And sometimes it's like they don't even want it. And, you know, and a lot of it comes from a place of, well, I need to be needed. You know, that's one of the items on the scale, actually, is I need to be needed. And when that number is off the charts, you can do all sorts of things for egoistic reasons, but not for the real genuine helping motives.
There was a point relatively early in my career as I was joining boards and, you know, helping, because I don't work in a nonprofit. So, but I would go to these, you know, other non-for-profits and work. And I became very suspect of do-gooders, especially the people who were the most public of the do-gooders. And I think it was valid from my experience in terms of where things, because things often took a dark turn for most folks. There's a quote from the book that I want to read because it's one I read out to a number of people and they were all like, oh my God, I know all the people who are involved here. Quote, excessive helpers need to be needed and grandiose narcissists tend to have an easy time exploiting and maneuvering such people to their advantage. Typically the dynamic is toxic and codependent. And you go on to say grandiose narcissists eat codependence for breakfast. I know those couples.
So true. But these sorts of relationships can happen in lots of different ways. And I was requested by my publisher to take out a paragraph I had in there where I talk about how I think that this is perfectly encapsulates the self-help industry.
Yeah. They made you take that out?
They told me to take it out. They're like, you're kind of in the self-help industry. You don't want to play nice. Okay. But I said it. I just said it just now, didn't I? On this podcast, the Second City podcast. You know, I see that dynamic a lot in the self-help world, and I see that certainly. I see it a lot in cults. You know, I see it a lot in lots of different. So anyway, at the group level as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, the term dark healers was the one that I was also, and that those are. You know, cultists you're right. Like that, you know, I was fascinated when I heard about some of the history of chiropractic, that was a lot of like where the early anti-vax stuff came from. And I'm like, really? And then you're like, oh, that's a little fringy. Okay. Maybe I can see that.
What's the word again?
What, the chiropractic people being anti-vax?
Oh yeah. That's right. Yeah. That's fascinating. It's fascinating. People eternally fascinate me. I'm not going to be out of a job anytime soon. Just when I wrote this on Twitter the other day, just when I think I've understood some idea about humans. Yeah. Then I go on Twitter or X or whatever.
I still call Twitter. I'm monitoring my social media in a way that I used to not. Because the algorithms have changed for sure. I'm seeing things I didn't see, and I'm still on Twitter X, though less frequently. I'm over on Blue Sky a little bit more, but all of it still feels like I understand I'm not designing it. It's happening to me. And I'm more and more, I want to design the way I encounter the world.
You want to be intentional. You want to live an intentional life. Mm-hmm. That's very in line with the idea of psychological flexibility. That's the idea of the whole book I wrote is you want to be in the driver's seat.
Highly sensitive people, HSPs.
Just come. Why don't you just bring up all the most controversial things of my book, Cully?
Hey, that's what sells. But okay, like I don't know that I'd heard that term. I'll just be honest with you. I mean, it makes perfect sense. What's the thought? But where does that come out of the literature, this idea?
Well, Aileen Aron really pioneered the study of highly sensitive people. And, it does resonate with a lot of people. It resonates with me. I was featured in a movie recently called Sensitive Men Rising. So that's I think I'm probably on that spectrum, high on that spectrum. But it's just a blend of two personality traits, neuroticism and openness to experience. So people, we're all blends of different traits. You know, you can be all sorts of, this is what makes individual snowflakes. You know, you can be a highly extroverted, neurotic person who's low in openness. You can be high conscientiousness, low openness, high extroversion, low agreeableness. Do you know what I'm saying? It's just like we're all blends of things. So the highly sensitive personality is the blend of neuroticism and openness to experience. And it's an interesting actually paradoxical combination if you really think about it, because you're so open to the world that you let so much in that of course you're going to become neurotic about it. Like it's a lot to deal with, you know? And so I have a lot of compassion for my fellow HSPs, but I roll my eyes when I see HSPs on the forums talking about how they have a superpower. Being HSP makes you a better person than, like, I see this all the time in groups where you just have group pride, but then you just go the complete opposite direction and you start to have like HSP supremacy or whatever, trait supremacy. I'm inventing this term right now.
Yes.
I'm inventing that. First time that ever came out of my mouth. But, you know, and I just think it's like, you can be an asshole HSP, right? Like, it doesn't necessarily make you a good person.
You talk about the study that Kadzik and Moran devised. If I'm saying that right, where they devised a scale to measure signaling high sensitivity.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that, can you talk about those incredible results?
Yeah, people who report that they signal their high sensitivity everywhere they go, you know, like, you know, you go like to a funeral and you're like, I'm sorry, I'm crying, I'm highly sensitive. You know, it's just like you have to announce it everywhere you go. That is correlated with vulnerable narcissism. So there you go. There's the correlation. And I'm not talking about small correlation. I'm saying like really high correlation. But here's the really interesting thing. There wasn't a very high correlation between people who score high in HSP traits and signaling it. So I think that's the curveball here. Most HSPs don't really feel the need to signal. In fact, there's a lot of them are really shy. A lot of them are really, you know. So the high sensitivity signalers, it actually was correlated more with the dark triad. and I think this is a common theme you see a lot throughout the book. You also see it with the act. I don't know if you were going to get there with the narcissistic activists, but the ones that are the signalers, that's what's particularly correlated with dark triad traits.
Sure. I mean, there are, you know, certainly on Twitter, there are a group of those people who I think many people have sort of discovered, these activists who, you know, are grifting on the side and are starting to get called out, but often they just keep going with the grift and, you know, and they're, I guess the shame button doesn't work there. Like one hopes it would.
Yeah, you're right. And I don't know if it's always like, I don't know what the definition of a grift is, if it has to just be for monetary gain, but there's also emotional gain. Grifting? I don't know. Maybe it is. But there's, you know, vulnerable narcissism. A lot of it is like, if I keep signaling my vulnerability, I know that I get special things, you know, like, you know, I was just, you know, I almost died this morning. This is a true story. I was in the bathroom of this coffee shop and I put my jacket on the metal rail. The whole rail with all the sharp edges and everything came down on me. My first immediate thought was like, Sue, I'm going to sue. But I was fine. My back didn't hurt, whatever. Anyway, I just went out and told the people there that worked there. I was like, you might just want to know. That thing is loose and almost killed me. Like, I'd like to save the next person, but I didn't play the victim, because the truth was I was fine.
Yeah.
But you know, that's an example. It's very easy to go through your life playing the victim all the time. It is easy. And if you learn that you get special things from it, you know, that can be almost addicting. I think it can be addicting in any environment, you know, to say like, oh, but wait, I have this, or wait, I have that disorder, or wait, I have, you know, at every moment. And that's really just what I talk about in my book. I'm not talking about singular declarations of victimhood in appropriate contexts, That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about perpetual victimhood. That's really what I take on in this book, is the perpetual victimhood mindset.
All right. So I have this weird analogy that I might edit out if, depending on this, how this falls. And this is considering all these different sort of personality tests and the mixtures and the different sort of people. So prior to COVID, my wife Ann was a good cook, and she made cocktails and stuff, and all good. COVID happens. She ups the cooking game to extreme levels, as you've probably seen some of my posts and the meals she makes. And then she's like, why am I making the cocktails and the meals? You got to figure out the cocktail thing. And like, I'm a novice at that. So I'm sort of like, I can make a, like, you know, whatever, I like a rum and Coke. I don't know how to make other. So I jumped in, I read some stuff. I started, and what I figured out is essentially there's like five different kinds of cocktails. It just depends the different mixtures you put in and how much.
Hmm.
And they can, they change by small degrees. So if I'm working with an Amaro and a bourbon, and then a bitters here, and then I got like a coffee liqueur, I could start popping a little bit. And so I suddenly didn't need a recipe. I didn't need, because I sort of understood what the feel of these different mixtures were. But what it was really sort of about, like, is like, yeah, there's five or six of these things that are the different kinds of cocktails you can have. And all of them can be off if you like put in, you know, all bourbon and a splash of something else. That's not good. So it's trying to find this mixture where they all sort of weave together in a way that can make a successful cocktail. And I kind of feel like what we're talking about here is like, you're going to have some neuroticism. It would be great if that acted a little bit more like the bitters, where you're just adding in a couple dashes.
Yeah.
But if you've got more of it, maybe there's some other stuff to balance that out. I don't know. Like,
I think you should keep this in.
Okay.
Regardless of my reaction. No, I think there's a lot of wisdom there. And really an implication of what you're saying is, you know, if the final cocktail could speak, it would not say, I am defined by my bitterness, or whatever that one ingredient was.
Yeah.
I think that's the point here. And as humans, we define ourselves by a singular. I am a highly sensitive person, and it really limits our flexibility in this world. But also, it's not correct. You are not the same thing as this one aspect of you. You know, it's just like the same thing with our thoughts. You know, with a meditation practice, you realize you are not your thoughts. And so, the more you can, and now I'm just like straight Buddha. Buddha rule book, playbook, you know, the things I'm saying, but not identify. We live in such a strong, like, pro-identity culture. And I think a lot of what I'm saying is, let's return to this Buddha way of thinking about everything, where, like, you know, you're not this one. The totality of you is much grandier.
Yeah, well, look, the Buddhism and improv share a lot of things. You know, some of our phrases are play the scene you're in, not the scene you want to be in. The idea of being fiercely in the moment.
Love that.
Not living in the past or an imagined future. And your only job is to save the person across from you, and their job is to save you.
So you guys nailed it.
This is the space you. Well, it's not. You know what's fascinating? I don't know if you and I have talked about this, but, you know, this work all started at, you know, the University of Chicago, where the son of Viola Spolin, who invented all the improv games, was studying. So if you look at the 50s, who was teaching at the University of Chicago? Martin Buber was there.
Oh, wow. Buber
was there. Yeah, wow. They were all there. Milton Friedman as well, on a side I don't like as much. But they were all there, like some of the greatest thinkers. And they didn't have a theater department. So this group of, you know, rebels sort of form their own thing.
I love that.
But it's all part and parcel. One of the lines that I really loved, and I actually used it the other day when I was doing a talk and I credited you, is you say, quote, while joyfulness is not an easy path, neither is joylessness. That sums up the book.
It's so true. It's so true. I love it. Did I say that?
Yeah, you said that. Good quote.
Where did I say that? I love it. I want to quote myself someday.
That's in chapter 9 towards the end. Live gratefully.
Wow. Wow. Yeah, that sounds like something I would say for sure.
Well, this is, and you know, when we were working with the behavioral scientists at the University of Chicago, this idea of gratitude came up over and over and over again, especially with Nick Epley's work. And I remember Nick actually saying to me one time, he's like, if you're in a bad mood, go do something nice for someone. And that has been the best advice that I've, you know, ever gotten. It is proven true to this day. And maybe part of that is the healthy selfishness that you talk about, which is like, I'm doing this and I am doing it to make myself feel better, but it also makes them feel better. And that kind of makes it as much of a win-win as it could possibly be.
Oh, that's so interesting. Yeah. You just added some additional nuance without realizing it that I hadn't thought of about the healthy selfishness construct and how you can, you can be high in pathological altruism in a healthy, selfish way. Anyway, you got me, the nerd in me is like, wow, you just actually identified a new category of something. But anyway, we'll move on.
Oh, I like that. Yeah.
Thank you, Kelly.
Just a couple more things. You talk about the need for a quiet ego. Talk about
that. Yes. Yes. Quiet ego is one of my favorite constructs in psychology. One of my favorite underrated constructs in psychology. Because it just says, just dial down the volume on your ego just enough where you can listen to other perspectives. And it's not really asking that much, but it seems like it's asking so much these days out of people. It just feels like everyone's screaming at each other, competing for a victimhood and not listening to each other's pain. And I think that's really sad. You know, I think that we need to yes end this, my friend. Mm-hmm. How do we like yes end that where you're like, yes, I'm a victim and I still have space in my heart to hear about your victimhood. And man, I just wish we had more of that.
Yeah. Yeah. I've talked to you about the thank you because exercise, right?
I think so. To remind me, please.
So the idea is, and this came out of not just Epley's work, but some other, and helped design the exercise. But when you're trying to speak through difference, one of the ways that you do that is thank the person for their opinion, even if you don't agree with it. And the because is where you find something of value in what they said, no matter how small.
Oh, yeah.
And that allows the conversation to go forward because you've kind of set off the gratitude part of the brain, but then you see the person feels seen. And it doesn't take much. This is the thing. I think we all think that, like, well, I'm going to have to sacrifice my values. You don't have to sacrifice your values to say you appreciate someone who cares so much about their thing, because that's enough. That's going to be enough for them in most cases, unless you're dealing with like a darkly narcissistic human being or whatever. But most people aren't like that. So I'm down in Texas at doing this interactive keynote yesterday, and I have people do the yes and exercise. And then they're telling me that once they've yes-anded the party I want them to throw, what's happening at the party. And this one person went all in on getting President Donald Trump there, and he's going to be wearing bell-bottom jeans. And there's all this thing of just like, these are not politics I share. It didn't matter. This woman was so appreciative of what I was bringing to her, which I felt great about because she was hearing what I was saying. And the politics don't matter at that point. You know, we were seeing each other on this human connection. So I think, how do we do this? I think we start with us and we extend our circles in our groups because it's not going to happen person to person. It's not going to happen institution to institution. Probably going to happen group to group. So we got to find our groups.
Yeah. And I also would say maybe this is the time where I bring in that statistic that I was going to say earlier that I said edit out. But yeah.
Yep.
Because I do think that treating individuals as individuals is the way to go. Because what we're doing right now is we've never been more divided in our country in terms of what psychologists have identified is they call it political sectarianism, where we are much more interested in hating the out-group than we are in loving our in-group. Like, none of us really likes the group we're in, but we hate our out-group more than we like the group we're in.
That's fair.
Especially Democrats these days.
Oh no, yeah, we're the worst.
Yeah, yeah, like, you know, we're like, Democrats don't really love being a Democrat these days, but we hate Trump more than we hate switching parties. Do you know what I mean? So yes. Here's an interesting statistic. Republicans estimate that 32% of Democrats are LGBT, when in reality it's 6%. And Democrats estimate that 38% of Republicans earn over $250,000 per year, when in reality it's only 2%. So I think the point here is that really to treat individuals as individuals. If you meet someone and all you know is their political view, and then you just ascribe and assume all these extra things about them without even talking to them or without even getting a chance to listen to them, I think that you're already limiting the great potential you could have there for a connection, great potential you could have there for having a human surprise you, you know? So mm-hmm. I'm not saying they'll always surprise you, but I'm saying give them a chance.
So what's the response so far you're getting in the book? What are you hearing?
Just so positive. I'm so pleased. I mean, the amount of blurbs I got from people I really, really respect in my field who've read it, and because I was so nervous, I was like, yeah. You know, but everyone so far from every part of the political aisle, I mean, have been like, yes, you know, and so that's promising to me, you know. Except there was just one person who stood up with blue hair. Who stood the rainbow colored hair, who stood up during that virtual. I said that I started off this interview telling you about that one person, but besides that one person, maybe that's just that is what it is. No matter who you are, you always get at least one person who doesn't agree with you.
Were you at all successful in talking to this person at that point?
Or was I was proud of my response. And at the end of the day, I think that's the best you can do, is to be able to say something that allows you to look at yourself in the mirror, right? And be like, I'm proud of, yeah, you know, the way I responded to this, because you don't want to back down from your beliefs and your worldview, but you still want to say you care about theirs. And
the book is,
you know, it was like, yeah, I was like, thank you for presenting your perspective. If at the end of the day, we do have a different worldview, then I'm okay with that. I can live in a world where we have different worldviews, you know, but at the end of the day, I'm not going to back down from saying that I think people from all demographics can rise above.
I love it. The book is called Rise Above, Overcome a Victim Mindset, Empower Yourself, and Realize Your Full Potential. Scott Barry Kaufman, thanks again for coming on the pod.
Thanks, Kelly. It made my day.
Me too.
Getting to Yes And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor is Iridian Fierro from WGN. We get support at the Second City from Colleen Fahey, Mike Farinaccio, and Emma Smith. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. For more information about the Second City, you can go to www.secondcity.com, or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.
Adulthood, no one survives.